Welcome to this session of the Futures Forum. This year, all our sessions are asking what sort of future are we creating for Australians in 2040? Our theme today is what people will own in 2040 and reflects a number of modern trends, including the so-called sharing economy and sophisticated recycling strategies. Our special guest, Dr. Chris Reedy, is a long-time friend of the Futures Foundation. Chris is Associate Professor at the Institute for Sustainable Futures, which is part of the University of Technology in Sydney. He works as a facilitator and change agent to help deliver personal, organisational, systemic and cultural responses to sustainability challenges. Some of you may have heard Chris recently talking about today's issues with Richard Aidy on The Money on Radio National. Chris is particularly interested in the areas of integrative research, applied foresight and deliberative democracy. He's a member of the editorial board for the two leading foresight journals, Futures and the World Future Review. Welcome, Chris. What can you tell us about what we'll own in 2040?
Thank you, Charles. What will we own in 2040? Yes. I guess ownership is something that's got a very long history, probably as long as people have being consciously people, we've had this idea that we own something, something belongs to us, it's part of our sense of self, that this is me, this is my stuff, this is not somebody else's, it belongs to me. And certainly ideas of ownership date back to some of the earliest written records that we have. They were important enough to make an appearance, of course, in the Ten Commandments in Thou Shalt Not Steal. So there's no concept of stealing if we don't have a concept of ownership. So this concept's been around for a very long time, and it's very deeply ingrained. It's a deep, powerful social and cultural norm. There's a lot of pressure on people to consume, to buy, to own, coming from the economic system, coming from peer pressure. So all of this idea of buying, of owning, of consuming is very deeply ingrained. It's got a long history, so it's probably not reasonable to think that in 2040 we're not going to own things anymore. We are, but there's some signs that the kind of things that we own are going to change, that there'll be shifts in who owns and what we own. And so I want to talk about some of the drivers for these shifts, what are prompting the interest in ownership and why it might look different in 2040. Some of this, of course, will be familiar, but I come from the Institute for Sustainable Futures, and we've got a mission to create change towards sustainable futures. And so for me, I'm interested in these issues very much from a sustainability perspective of what does ownership mean for sustainability, and what might new types of ownership, new ideas about ownership, contribute to helping us to live more sustainably on the planet. Because right now, as I'm sure you know, we're using up 1.6 planet Earths, and that simply can't be sustained. So ecological footprint is well above what the Earth can sustain, and that means that we're eating into our natural capital. And a lot of that is driven by ownership, by consumption, by everybody needing to own all the same things and repeat all the same tasks with their own versions of products, of cars, of whatever else it might be. So we're eating up the forest, the oceans, the atmosphere, ecosystems, diminishing the planet, and increasingly perhaps make it more difficult for ourselves to be sustained on this planet, and certainly for other species. And I love the work that's been done on planetary boundaries by Will Steffen and Johan Rockström and others, that tries to tease out, well, yes, in that big picture we're using 1.6 planet Earths, but what are the boundaries that we need to be staying under? What are the areas where we're in most trouble and need to be paying attention? So they've teased out 9 planetary boundaries and tried as much as possible to quantify how we're going against those boundaries. Are we staying under them, or are we transgressing them? And they've found, and they haven't been able to quantify all of them yet, but they found that at least for 4 of them, we're living beyond the boundaries already. So biosphere integrity, the loss of biodiversity that we're seeing around the world, is unsustainable. It's at rates that simply can't be replaced. Land system change, deforestation, desertification, changes in land use are also at unsustainable levels. climate change, of course, which we hear so much about, but also flows of nutrients, the flows of nitrogen and phosphorus out of soils into oceans and rivers are at well beyond sustainable levels. So those are four areas that are particular problems for us, and we need to find ways to live below the environmental ceiling defined by those planetary boundaries. But that's only part of our challenge. We've also got the challenge of, well, finding ways to live under that environmental ceiling, finding also ways to lift up people that don't have an adequate social foundation, that aren't experiencing the kind of standard of living that we in developed countries experience, that don't have access to food and water and healthcare, that don't have a voice in the kind of decisions that affect them. So I love this work by Kate Raworth that was quite influential in leading into the Sustainable Development Goals developed through the United Nations, that looked at the space that we need to be finding a way to live in to be sustainable, the safe and just space for humanity, which she called the donut model because of the shape of it, obviously. But it shows the twin challenges we have to find ways to get smaller, in a way, to live within the boundaries of the planet and yet deliver more for more people around the world so that we can deliver justice for the many people living in poverty. And this has, of course, been reflected in recent times in the Global Goals for Sustainable Development, the 17 Global Goals that really try and lay out what the challenge is. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but avoiding poverty, avoiding hunger, health and education, reducing inequalities, improving our marine systems, our land ecosystems, climate action and renewable energy. So many different goals that the world has committed to try and move towards a more sustainable future. So this huge sustainability challenge is a lot of it driven by the amount that we consume. Of course, that's not all of it. There's population pressures and so on. But a lot of it comes back to consumption. And consumption, for me, comes back to ownership. So sustainability thinkers have realised for a long time that if we're going to tackle consumption, that we need to start thinking about new ownership models. So the idea that we don't need access to products and the materials required to make those products, what we actually desire is the service that those products deliver, has been around for a long time in sustainability circles. And it's starting to become much more mainstream through things like the sharing economy. But the idea of the circular economy, where products are not delivered once and then disposed, but are perhaps more durable, are taken back into the system and reused or refurbished, is a big part of sustainability thinking. Extended producer responsibility, where manufacturers and retailers take the products that they've made, remain responsible for them, take them back at the end of their life, means perhaps that we don't need to have such a big total stock of goods and we don't need to consume so much materials from the earth. So if we can make materials more durable to circle in systems that are a bit more like natural ecosystems, then all of a sudden we're taking less from the earth and maybe we're getting down below some of those boundaries I was talking about earlier. So it's important then to think that ownership really is a means to an end. It's not like we desire to own goods for the sake of it. We usually desire them to achieve something. That's not always the case. Some people just love cars and they might want to own one, not so much to get from point A to B, but because they love looking at the thing. And so that's certainly something to consider. But in a lot of cases, what we're looking for is the service that those products provide. And we don't need to own something necessarily to get that service. So we've seen these ideas, which have been around for a long time, I should say, in sustainability circles. None of this is very new. But what is new is the packaging, in a way, the bringing together of these ideas into the sharing economy ideas. I prefer to use the term sharing paradigm, because sharing economy brings a monetization to the process that has been criticized for colonizing our social relationships, the good things that we like to do with each other, the relationships, the sharing that we do anyway, shouldn't always be economic. So when we're thinking about sharing It's a term used by McLaren and Agyeman in their great book Sharing Cities, is a preferable term as the sharing paradigm, that what we're trying to encourage is sharing of all kinds. Some of that will be economic, some of that will involve for-profit enterprises, some of it will be much more about encouraging non-monetized sharing within our cities. So that's the term I prefer to use. It hasn't really taken off yet, but we'll see. But Rachel Botsman was one of the people that really started to popularise the idea of the sharing economy, which she called collaborative consumption when she was first talking about it. And this is one of her slides, and it shows quite clearly the difference that she was seeing between current models of the way the economy works, current models of ownership, and a future that's much more about access rather than ownership. So she was seeing the 20th century as an era of hyper-consumption, characterised by people's credit ratings being really important in terms of their reputation, by advertising, pushing products to us as passive consumers, and by individual ownership, by having to have the things that you own yourself. And she argued that we're moving into this era of collaborative consumption in the 21st century, where your reputation as you move through many different digital platforms will be carried with you, and it's the way that you engage with others, with peers, in those different social relationships that you're in that will be much more important than your credit rating in those spaces. That community and the recommendations of people that we trust, of our peers, through social networks, through social media, will be much more important than advertising in directing us towards the kind of things that we decide to own or decide to access. And then shared access to the things that we need will be the core of this kind of economy, rather than having to necessarily own something. So this was a few years ago that Rachel Botsman put these ideas forward in the book What's Mine Is Yours. And of course that's since been critiqued a bit in a book called What's Yours Is Mine by Tom Slee, which was quite clever, because of what I was talking about before, because of the monetization of social relationships, of private peer-to-peer transactions that starts to happen, and what we've seen happening with things like Airbnb and Uber, for example, starting to turn a relationship that might have been about sharing your couch or your room with someone into an economic transaction. So that sort of approach has started to be criticised a bit. But she laid out quite nicely the drivers that are leading toward this new idea of the collaborative economy or the sharing economy. And I've already talked about the environmental pressures, so that's certainly one of them, that if we can be sharing more products, particularly products that are idle a lot of the time, then we can be using less of the resources of the planet. But technological innovation has been really important. Of course, sharing is nothing new. It's been around as long as people have been around. But the digitalization, the rise of the internet, of social media, communications technologies, has enabled something new, a new type of sharing. So sharing used to be with people that you know. Now it can be with people that you don't know. Those technologies can facilitate hooking up with people if you've got enough critical mass and density to let that happen. That's not always the case. There's certainly big parts of the world where that's not the case, and so this works a lot better in the dense cores of cities than in the rest of the world. But the new technologies, as they disperse, have really facilitated new kinds of peer-to-peer transactions and peer-to-business. We're also seeing values shifts, the rise of new generations that are more mobile, that are more interested in community, that don't necessarily feel the desire to own things, and in some cases, because of the economic realities, which is another driver, things like housing affordability challenges, can't see a pathway to being able to own things like property, so have developed values that put less emphasis on that, and more emphasis on things like their communities, their social networks. And the economic realities, when Rachel Botsman did this work, it was coming out of the global financial crisis, and people were looking for ways to make better use of resources just for financial reasons, so that was also a driver. And with economies not really recovering strongly, that remains a driver for a lot of people, I think. So these drivers have come together to contribute to that paradigm shift that she's talking about in how we live and work, and certainly what we own. And one of the important aspects of the shift is a shift in power of consumers. So moving from a situation where people are passive consumers being pushed products by advertising to a situation where consumers are potentially much more active. They're creating their own products, they're sharing them with their peers, they're collaborating, they're moving into cooperatives. We're starting to see the emergence of more cooperatives again. We're seeing things like benefit corporations starting to emerge, peer-to-peer solutions rather than relying so much on businesses. So, and movements like Creative Commons and so on. Just a couple of examples of those kind of things that I just came across today. Stocksy is a cooperative set up by artists who provide stock photography and stock artwork that distributes the profits between the people involved. So just one example of what we're seeing is an emergence of cooperatives where people are owning their own businesses and delivering their own value. Hepburn Wind Farm is another example, a community-owned wind farm where people have banded together in a cooperative to generate their own power. And we're seeing the emergence of lots more community energy initiatives as well. But it's not all rosy, of course. It's not all heading towards this future of sharing and collaboration and cooperatives. We're also seeing other trends that could take us in quite different directions. So businesses seeking to extend concepts of ownership into new spaces, to colonise areas where ownership and property rights have not been before. So patenting of genes and crops, for example, collection of big data as a financial resource and on selling that to others. And as I've already talked about, the idea that the sharing economy is actually commercialising social transactions that should remain perhaps just a social good that doesn't always need to have a dollar value attached to it. Particularly with some of the social psychology research that shows that once you do attach a dollar value to something, that does diminish that the value of that thing. People would much prefer to do things for intrinsic reasons rather than the extrinsic reasons of financial value. But we've seen, you know, the shift from the early kind of sharing initiatives like couch surfing, which was all free and was about people landing on someone's couch and telling some stories as the way to pay for that, if you like, to Airbnb, where people are actually buying into people's homes. And while that experience is great, it is also leading to problems with particular parts of cities becoming heavily sold through Airbnb, changing the character of neighbourhoods, making it difficult for some people to live in those areas, so causing various kinds of economic flow-on effects. And you can think of a different example being the shift from hitchhiking, and of course it was already not so many people doing that because of safety concerns, but the commercialisation of that through something like Uber. We're seeing intellectual property and big data replacing capital as sources of power, with the power that's accruing to companies like Google and Facebook. And what remains really uncertain for me in thinking about this issue of ownership is how are these trends going to play out? So the trend towards more corporate ownership versus the trend towards more collective ownership. It's a key source of uncertainty about the future. And if I was doing scenarios on this, that's one of the axes I would certainly choose. So I haven't done scenarios on this, but the Forum for the Future in the UK has done some that are loosely related to this topic. They were about consumer futures, and they're only looking ahead to 2020, not as far as we're looking here to 2040. But they're instructive in terms of at least the axes that they've chosen. And so one of them is similar to what I was just talking about. Are we looking at a future that they describe as do-it-yourself, where there's much more engagement by the consumer, they're much more active in economic transactions, they're creating value for themselves? Or is it a do-it-for-me future, where, again, a much more passive consumer, the power accrues to corporations who then push out products to consumers that accept those products. So that was a really key distinction for them in developing these scenarios. The other, because this was again coming out of the global financial crisis, was what level of prosperity are we looking at by 2020? Will we be well into a recovery with economic growth returning to the levels that existed back in 2007? Or are we going to be in a less prosperous future where perhaps we're still struggling on and maybe some of the challenges of sustainability are starting to affect economic prosperity? So they use those axes to develop these scenarios. I'm not going to go into them too much, but just a little bit is that the My Way scenario, which is the DIY prosperous kind of future, is a high-tech world. It's characterized by things like local trade, community entrepreneurs, organic products, apps that are very personalized that can get you the data you need about the products that you want to choose, smart packaging, people using technology themselves in their cooperatives, in their social enterprises to develop the kind of products that are important to them. So very engaged communities, very engaged forms of consumption, and ownership that's very distributed and much more cooperative. In the sell it to me future, it's a do it for me future in a prosperous world, and it's the future of big data, of corporations providing products to people, heavy branding, not necessarily a very sustainable future, that one. The from me to you scenario, the DIY, less prosperous future is much more characterized by peer-to-peer transactions, by lots of local DIY and repair and reuse, making the best you've got with the local things that you have. And then the I'm in your hands future, the do it for me, less prosperous future, they saw as a very heavily branded future where people are trying to save money because it's not a prosperous kind of future, and they're therefore relying on brands, trusting brands to deliver everything. So they'd have a totally branded bathroom where every product in there is from a particular brand because it's cheaper to deliver that in bulk than to have lots of different products. So those are instructive, but particularly I like the distinction between the do-it-yourself, do-it-for-me future. What are we heading towards? Are we heading towards a future where ownership is much more concentrated with corporations or much more distributed with people and communities? And I don't know which of those are most likely to come about, but what I thought I'd do for the second half of this is look at some specific cases of ownership and how they seem to be playing out and see if that sheds any light on where it looks like we might be heading. So I thought I'd start with home ownership. It's the biggest asset that most people will ever own, so it's a good place to start. And I've laid out what I see as some of the key trends that are affecting home ownership there and some of the emerging responses. So certainly housing affordability is the issue that gets a lot of attention. It's continuing to worsen for younger generations. For a lot of younger people, it's hard for them to imagine how they could ever own a home. And so obviously they're turning to other kinds of solutions that might not involve ownership. There's the ongoing imperative for sustainability reasons to increase urban density, to move people closer to public transport nodes, to make better use of resources by having people closer together. Desire to be part of a community. I think the values are continuing to shift in the direction of people wanting to engage with others. Social networking and social media has perhaps facilitated that kind of thing. And although it means a lot of people engaging with each other offline, it also leads to perhaps more people wanting to catch up in person as well. And then mobile lifestyles and flexible careers of younger generations, people being much less tied to place than they used to be, is another key trend here. So some of the responses we're seeing are things like co-housing, deliberative development, and co-living and co-working, which I'll talk about each of those. But the question I'm asking myself here is, will home ownership become rare as people favour access to a lifestyle, a location, and a community over being tied to a place? So I'm doing quite a bit of work on co-housing at the moment, so I'll start off with that. And the particular project that we have is looking at co-housing as a response to an ageing population, so co-housing for seniors, but the kind of issues that we're seeing apply beyond that specific case. So co-housing has been defined as a form of community living that contains a mix of private and communal spaces. So you get the best of both worlds. You get a space where you can retreat and have your privacy, but also spaces that are shared where you can have a sense of community and collaboration. And what it often means is that you might have a slightly smaller dwelling, and by sacrificing some of the space in that dwelling, you can, as part of the overall development, include shared spaces, a common house perhaps, where you can have shared meals, common garden areas, lounge areas, whatever else it might be. Many different models. There's no sort of single idea of what this looks like. That diagram that I've put up is one kind, but there's many other scales of this and new models emerging all the time, as we're finding out in our research. Here's one concrete example down in Melbourne, Murrindukka in Heidelberg Heights. 18 dwellings across what was previously three suburban blocks. These were bought up by a housing cooperative down there, and they ran the development. They built the 18 dwellings and shared community spaces, a shared common house, a reuse area, community gardens, to create those shared spaces for people. In this particular case, the residents are renting, so it's a social cooperative. They pay a capped rent that I believe is based on their income, and they don't have ownership over these properties. That's not always the case. In a lot of other co-housing cases, there is still ownership, but it shows that there are models where ownership is not part of it. Really small scale example, a colleague of mine, Suzanne Benn at UTS, they bought up two adjacent terrace houses in Balmain and renovated those so that they had access between their backyards. They have a shared space up the top which has got guest rooms and shared laundries, and their own private dwellings down the bottom. So she and her son live there in the different dwellings. So often there's an intergenerational aspect to this as well, and sort of the old idea of the granny flat, but taken into the 21st century, if you like. And in this case, they own the place. But what the characteristics of these kind of co-housing developments are that there's typically resident involvement in the design of the co-housing development. So they'll come together beforehand to think about, where do we want to live? What do we want this place to look like? They'll be involved in the design process. Once it's built, they'll have some self-governance and active participation by the residents. They'll manage the community themselves. There's always some sort of common facilities. The scale of that varies, whether it's a big common house where they share meals to the smaller shared spaces in the Balmain example. I'm looking at an example down in Austenmere where they bought up a block and have built three properties on it. There's no shared building, but they share the garden spaces and have designed so that the outdoor spaces are shared. But importantly, there's often use of social contact design in developing these properties, so that when you get home, instead of just retreating into your private dwelling, you'll move through the community spaces and you'll see what sort of conversations are going on, and maybe you want to join them, maybe you don't, but at least you can have that opportunity and you feel like you're coming home to a place that's got other people in it rather than just a isolated home. Typically it's not like a commune or an intentional community in the sense that there's no shared community economy or ideology. And as I've been saying, ownership varies in different models. It can be cooperative ownership, that's fairly common, but it can also still be private ownership and title. Now, co-housing has been around for a long time. It came out of the Netherlands, or no, Denmark. It's been tried a lot in Europe, quite a bit now in the States. It's still fairly new in Australia. But what we're seeing emerging is new kinds of models that draw on the principles of co-housing, but try and deliver them in a way that's more mainstream, that's more consistent with the sort of paradigms that are coming out with the sharing paradigm. So one that's getting a lot of energy right now is the Nightingale model of deliberative development down in Melbourne. I think they've just licensed their 10th property to go out and develop on this model. And the way the model works is that an architect, a designer will decide to go down this path. They'll call together people that are interested in being part of this development. And like in a co-housing approach, they'll consult them on, well, what would you like in this development? Would you be happy to trade off a little bit of the size of your dwelling to have a shared roof space that you can use to socialise with other people, or a shared laundry facility so you can take the laundry out of the dwellings? And what we've been seeing in pretty much every case of this that's been done is that, yeah, they want to trade off some of that private space for a shared communal space, a sense of community. And just bringing people together in that part of the process starts to build that sense of community as well, so that people feel like they're buying not into a property, into a dwelling, but they're buying into a community that they can be a part of. So this model has been hugely popular, oversubscribed, big in Melbourne. There's little, there's Urban Growth New South Wales has been looking into taking it into New South Wales. Greens have been looking at taking it into the ACT. Lots of interest in this at the moment. But it's still a model where people are owning their space. They're buying into something different. They're feeling like they own a community, but it's still ownership. Taking it one step further is something that we're seeing emerging in the US, which is what's been called co-living. And it's also been called dorms for adults. So the example I've put up is called The Common. It's in New York. And you basically, it could be described as housing by subscription. So instead of actually buying into a property, you pay a monthly subscription. For that, you get a private bedroom. You get something that's fully furnished. All of the utilities are covered. You get your Wi-Fi, the cleaning's done, there's shared supplies that are brought in, laundry, and there's shared spaces. So you've got people that you can get and engage with, you can feel like you're part of a community. And if you need to move somewhere else, you can do it in 24 hours into another one of their properties. So they're not widespread yet, so that's not a big benefit so far, but as it moves further, you can imagine that if people with those mobile lifestyles I was talking about before that suddenly need to be in Boston or Chicago instead of in New York and quickly be there, and it's just part of their subscription for housing. So that's the shift from ownership way into an access economy where people are accessing housing of the kind that they want that has some community associated with it rather than needing to own something. Now, that sort of model might not appeal to everyone. Some of the comments about this kind of thing were, why the hell would you want to live in a dorm again after you finally got out of one? but a lot of people in there seem to love it, and it starts to ask the question of, well, what with the housing affordability challenges that people have with these mobile lifestyles, will this become much more common by 2040? And I think it probably will. Right, I want to move on to mobility, vehicles, and the key trends that we're seeing here are, again, that idea of needing access to mobility rather than having to necessarily own a car, so car sharing really taking off. Automation, lots of companies, Google, Tesla, Lyft, Uber, looking at developing automated vehicles that don't even need drivers. Electrification of vehicles starting to address some of the sustainability challenges of automobiles. And in the broader mobility space, virtualization and the ability to engage with people in other places without having to be there, getting more and more capable over time. And emerging responses to these trends are things like car and ride sharing, Lyft and Uber as examples, but also things like GoGet in Australia. Autonomous vehicles starting to be trialled. There's one that Uber's been trialling in Pittsburgh recently, a self-driving vehicle, and virtual presencing becoming more and more realistic and capable. So will we own shares in mobility services like Uber and Lyft instead of vehicles by 2040? Certainly Lyft thinks so. This is from an article by John Zimmer, who was one of the co-founders of Lyft, and he points out that the average vehicle is used only for 4% of the time and parked the other 96%. So there's a huge amount of idle capacity there. Of course, it's not as high as it seems because they're all used at the same time, which is why we get traffic jams. But there's still a lot of idle capacity that could be tapped into there. And he argues that by 2025, private car ownership will all but end in major US cities. Perhaps a bit bullish, but the Rocky Mountain Institute came out with similar predictions just in the last week or so, arguing that we'll be at peak car in the next 5 years or so. And this being driven by the rise of services like car sharing, like Lyft and Uber. So Alex Stephan has said that ride sharing is just the first phase of the movement to end car ownership and reclaim our cities. And the kind of visions that companies like Uber and Lyft have is that the phase that we're in now, where we're seeing people with their private vehicles offering rides to others, is really only a stage on the way to a future where autonomous vehicles, driverless vehicles, will be zipping around the city, providing people with the mobility that they need, and cleverly picking up people that need to go on particular routes so that it can be done more efficiently. So they see a future where autonomous vehicles quite soon start to be working on fixed routes, then different routes but at a slow speed, and then finally moving to full autonomy quite soon. So all of this shift from ownership to access has been recently described as the subscription economy, and we've had enough of these terms, the collaborative economy, the sharing economy, now the subscription economy, but I think it's quite apt in that that example I put up of housing of the common is very much a subscription service for housing. Lyft and Uber have a desire to move towards a subscription for mobility. And here's another example coming out of the Netherlands of subscribing to laundry services. So it's called bundles. They give you a efficient modern Miele laundry appliance. They have washers and dryers. And you pay a monthly subscription. They provide everything, even the laundry detergent. So all you have to do is pay your subscription and do the washing. They sort out the rest. And Zuora, who coined this term, the subscription economy, has said that the kind of things that are making it attractive are up the top there. So it's delivering ongoing value to people. So instead of the devaluation that you get over time of an asset that you own, in a subscription situation, the company is taking back the product as it gets old and giving you a new version. And they might refurbish and upgrade it. It's providing memorable experiences through engagement with people through the subscription process. It's on-demand fulfillment, so you get access to what you need when you need it. Works anywhere in real time, and there's personalized service. So they see that as a big part of the future, and we've seen it obviously in music with Spotify, in videos with Netflix, and many other examples. The final sort of case I want to look at is changes in ownership of the means of production. And we're seeing trends in the ongoing improvement of 3D printing and additive manufacturing, the emergence of maker culture, of people wanting to tinker with things, hacker culture as well, of playing around with products and creating things themselves, the ongoing decline of manufacturing in the developed world, and the rise of peer-to-peer sharing. And what we're seeing emerging is this idea of bespoke local additive manufacturing as a possible response. And it's still very young, but the question I asked myself here was, will we own 3D printers and recyclers instead of durable products in 2040? So here's what you can get at the moment, the fifth generation of the MakerBot 3D printers. You can plug in your design and it pops out the product that you are looking for. It's still very young, this technology, in a lot of ways, but amazing kinds of things that can be delivered. And of course, it's not going to deliver everything that you need. I often think about the example of a drill, which was brought up by Rachel Botsman, that, you know, gets used for a few minutes in its entire lifetime and then sits in the garage for the rest of the time. And ideally, you'd be able to share a drill among lots of households, but because density is often not enough, you can't get the drill when you need it, it's often easier just to pop down to the local Bunnings and buy a drill, and they're not that expensive. They might not last very long, but you don't need them to last very long, so it becomes easier to just buy something rather than share it. The future that might emerge with something like this is that when you need a drill and you don't need it to last very long, and certainly the materials aren't adequate to this task yet, but you could print a drill, use it, put it into the recycler and dispose of it. And those materials would then be recycled and could be used in another product. So that's the kind of aspiration for this technology. It's certainly not there yet. Whether it will be there by 2040 with further developments in the technology is an open question, I think. But Birchnell and Uri, a couple of academics that have looked at this, said what could develop here would be something like the current downloading of digital music or films. People would not so much buy objects as pay for accessing or gaining a license to produce or download the design of one or more of the objects in question. This would be part of a growing access rather than ownership economy. So again, that idea of subscription, of access rather than ownership. So to conclude, what will we own in 2040? Well, I think there'll certainly be less individual ownership and more collective and or corporate ownership. I'm not willing to say what mix of those we'll be looking at in 2040. I personally hope for more of the collective approach, with a lot more benefit corporations and social enterprises and local community cooperatives emerging and owning things rather than big corporations selling things to people, but we'll see. Certainly a shift from ownership to subscription for access, so subscriptions to co-living and co-working environments, subscriptions to mobility services, subscriptions to 3D printer design libraries perhaps. And paradoxically, we might see both more durable, upgradable items that people own or get access to through the idea of extended producer responsibility in the circular economy. Those companies providing products as services will have an incentive to make them durable, upgradable, so that they don't have to just dispose of them with all the waste that would entail. But on the other hand, with the rise of 3D printing, we might see more disposable 3D printed items for particular uses that don't need to be so durable as well. Perhaps we'll be owning 3D printers and excellent immersive virtual environments, virtual reality goggles, virtual reality rooms instead of vehicles as our way of getting around. And I think ownership of intellectual property designs and data is going to be something that emerges as really important by 2040 as well. And I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Perfect timing as the lights go out.